swinging a high drive into center field. Hits at the wall. It is gone. Cassis does it again.
Again.
It's gone. It's into the bullpen. This game is tied. This game is tied.
And he swings and rips one to center field. It's high. It's deep. It's back. It's gone. Sale winds. He fires. Swing and a miss. Strike three. It's over. The Red Sox have won the World Championship.
Welcome back to Plague Tessie. It is episode 1. If you're listening on drop day, it is September 16th. This is the official podcast of Losing Games to Alex Verdugo, also known as the official Red Sox podcast of WEI. Before we get going, hit that subscribe button wherever you're listening, wherever you get your podcast, subscribe, rate us 5 stars, Apple, Spotify, Odyssey app, wherever. Also find us on YouTube. We're on the WEI channel. We've got a Plague Tessie playlist there where you can find all of our episodes, and you can hit the thumbs up button there because we really appreciate when you guys do that. So go do all those things. Find us on the socials, at Plague Tessie on both Twitter and Instagram. I'm here with Sammy, and I'm here with Pat, and the Red Sox just finished off a 4-game series against the New York Yankees. Damn, because if they had won the series or swept the series, we'd be having a really different conversation, not just because vibes would be better, but because the playoff position would be dramatically different. They'd be under 3 games if they'd won the series, but that's just not how the cards were dealt. That's not what the Red Sox did. They lost 3 out of 4 to the Yankees. If you listen to Cora's comments, to Alex Cora's comments after the game, he's talking like the season's over. I think it's fair to say, and like the issue is, it's hard because they're 4.5 out. The issue is if they win a game and the Twins lose a game, they're 3.5 out. And I know there's teams in the middle, but the issue is anytime you're 3.5 out, unless there's like 5 games left in the season, technically you're still in it. So we're kind of straddling that line of being in it versus out of it. But the issue is 4.5 out, multiple teams in front. That's and the manager and Alex Cora talking the way he's talking, where he has to kind of correct himself when he uses the past tense about the season. I think that tells you all you need to know. And you know what? It's okay. It's not okay, but it's okay, because I think back to what we thought at the beginning of the season, and I think back to now moving forward, it doesn't mean there's not a lot to talk about. The season is not over on August 1st, and we have 2 months of baseball watching to kill. That's not the way it is. No, we've got a couple of weeks. We've got some September call-ups that are playing well. Specifically, Zach Penrod came up this weekend and looked good. Luis Guerrero has looked good since his call-up. Like, guys are doing well. But that said, there are conversations to be had about this team moving forward. There are conversations about pathways to this team being really good next year. I think it is totally realistic for Red Sox fans to expect that this team should make the moves this offseason necessary to get this team to contention next year. But there's also storylines to talk about of things that happened in this Yankee series. Obviously, the Gerrit Cole stuff in Game 3. Obviously, the lack of bats and the fall off of the offense, which at this point is very well documented. But at this point, it's been a super extended stretch of extremely limited offense. And I guess we'll talk a little bit about Cora's bullpen usage, and I think a lot of people have been really upset about that lately. And I have some things to say about those people who are questioning Cora's bullpen usage. But that said, season as a whole, obviously they are not on path to make the playoffs. They're probably not going to make the playoffs. The playoff odds says they are almost dead certain to not make the playoffs. But that said, there are things to be encouraged by, both at the major league level and at the minor league level. There are steps forward that this team has taken. They've exceeded our expectations this year. I don't think any of us thought that they were going to be playing meaningful games that could upset us. Losing 3 out of 4 games could upset us in September. So they're not going to make the playoffs. But that said, I think we can all recognize, amid our frustrations, that this was a position that we didn't expect them to be in. And I think it sheds a positive light on the team moving forward. And maybe that's like as positive as I've been in an opening monologue thing that I do at the beginning of these episodes going in, but maybe that just shows like what I believed, where I believed the season was at coming into this series, because it upset me that they lost 3 out of 4. But like, if I actually truly thought that there was a chance they were going to make the playoffs going into this series, I would have been pretty damn pissed. And like, I don't know. I'm not happy about it, but it's not like it's killing me like it would.
I mean, it's just completely pathetic. It is beyond pathetic. Pathetic isn't even strong enough word to describe the state of the Red Sox. I know they have a bright future and we have a lot to look forward to, but the fact that we're borderline celebrating these guys for being close to making the playoffs, that is so just beyond sad. Not the Boston Red Sox. I don't even, do you guys think John Henry has a clue that these guys are completely dead in the water? Like, just so pathetic. Yes, they overachieved, but overachieving could not be 75-75 and missing the playoffs. That's loser shit. So, yeah, I'm having a tough time being positive. I'm not happy with the state of the team. I think Alex Cora is not happy with the state of the team. These guys, whatever balls they had are completely gone. They can't come through in the clutch. Where they 0-for-7 with runners in scoring position today? Why even bring a bat to the... Oh, like it's so frustrating. And I don't want to hear like all the like, oh, yeah, they exceeded expectations. Oh, we can't be that mad. I'm mad. These guys are...
Sammy, what are you mad in the scope of this series? Are you mad in the scope of the season? What specifically right now is making you mad?
Good question. A little bit of both. I mean, the series was just like, what a bunch of bums, man. I mean, they look completely gutless out there, making the dumbest errors at the worst times. They look like they're going to, you know, everyone says, oh, they got the dog in them. The dog that the Red Sox have in them is like a three-legged chihuahua that just got neutered. It's unbelievable. Like anytime there's any pressure the last month, they just crumble. And, you know, I've been trying to look at it like, yeah, you look at the team on paper heading into the season, they really overachieve expectations. But I can only kick the can down the road so much before it gets frustrating. And I'm like, can you guys get it the fuck together? This is pathetic. You have Gerrit Cole just handing you a win on a silver platter on Saturday, and then you barely show up on Sunday. Are you kidding me? Like, what team is this?
I'll answer it for you. I think this is a team that they'll say the right things. And like I want to say it was the Apple TV game. They had Sidon Rafaela really quickly before they took the field or something. And he said like, our goal, get into the playoffs. So they're saying the right things, but I think this is a team that their actions show that I think they know where they're at. And I guess that's not a good thing, but are your frustrations, like I agree. The last month, like the Red Sox and particularly the offense, I think it's a joke what the offense has become. And I think you can hold those guys accountable. I think the pitching, whether it be the rotation or especially the bullpen, these guys have been asked to do things that they've never done before. And to be honest with you, guys have exceeded expectations. Like the starting rotation.
That's why I'm mad. Guys have been asked to do, like why are we having so many guys?
Back up for a second. Are you mad because the bullpen is being asked to do more than they've ever done before? Because guys like, and like Cutter Crawford too, like these guys way above their inning limits. Like I get it. But the reason they're losing right now and the reason they've been so lifeless is the offense. And the offense isn't full of guys that haven't done this before. Like these guys have been through a full season. So to me, if you want to be frustrated, the area to be frustrated at is the offense, because that's where there's no excuses to me. These guys going from like the best offense in baseball for like the first month after the All-Star break to being where we are right now, where these guys can't even score like 4 runs a game. That's what's unacceptable to me.
In a micro sense right now, I think the offense is the issue. And that was frustrating to watch today. But in a general sense, if you want to give the macro view, I'm sick of having this conversation for the third year in a row. We're celebrating these guys because they're going to win 3 or 4 more games than the season, the last 2 years when they finished in last. Ooh, congratulations. Friggin' participation trophy. That's fantastic. We're back in the same spot, third year in a row. And I'm so sick of it. I don't want to even give these guys credit for this market improvement. And like the best thing to come out of this season is the farm system again. And I just like, how many times are we going to keep doing this? It's the Boston Red Sox. We shouldn't be talking about relief pitchers being in spots they shouldn't be in. You can buy anybody.
So I'm the more, because when you started when you first started speaking, you were calling the team, it were like a bunch of bums. Like, what the hell are we seeing here? But when we dig deeper inside your head, it sounds like we're reverting back to why the hell could we not get these guys the help they deserved in the offseason? Why did these guys not spend the money? Why is John, and you said John Henry. Like,
same conversation, though. All, it's all connected.
That's where the frustration should be, because I think if you look at it from an individual player level, like look at it player by player, how did this guy individually do relative to our expectations going in? I think for most guys entering the year, they either met or exceeded the expectation or they got hurt. And the reason the team is where it's at is, yeah, sure, it's because guys got hurt, but guys get hurt on every team. This team didn't have the depth and the talent necessary to get through the injuries because ownership didn't want to spend the money. And that's a conversation we're going to have over and over again. I want to give Pat a chance. Pat, you've been listening to us. What, just you must have something on the top of your head here. Like, where you must be frustrated. Like, where are your frustrations rooted? Like, where is your head at? Or do you think there's still a chance? And if you're frustrated, where is that rooted in?
I'm like a mishmash of everything that's been said. I think big picture wise, the clear fault here is roster construction. And I'm not blaming Craig Breslow. I am blaming ownership for not giving him the okay to spend on pieces that they have needed for 3 years now. But roster construction as a whole, Sammy, you said it. There's guys in the bullpen who are in spots they shouldn't be, are way beyond workloads that they've ever seen before. And we started talking about this in early June about the fatigue that was going to come in for the starters, the relievers, the young guys, and it's happening. And you did pretty much nothing to supplement any of that. You traded.
When you say did nothing, are you talking about the offseason before the season, or are you talking about the deadline?
Both. I think going into this season, you knew your five-man rotation. Let's start after Giolito got hurt. So you knew your rotation was going to be Bayo, Hauk, Cutter, Whitlock, obviously, who ended up getting hurt. And then Chris Wall was like a six, Pivetta. So you had no one there who was like a bona fide, I can trust this guy to pitch. So we'll start there. You did nothing at all to supplement that.
Third year in a row.
Yep. And then moving forward at the deadline. At that point, at the time of the trade deadline, Cutter was still pitching relatively well. Bayo was starting to turn it around. Hauk had just made an all-star appearance. And what you did was trade for a borderline 40-year-old, recently DFA, James Paxton.
Yeah.
So, and I was on board with that move. That was a cheap depth move. I like that. But to do nothing else on top, to me, was brutal. Now, to the present day, you can be mad at the offense because guys like Duran has been ice cold recently. Tyler O'Neill's been an absolute dog. Love him. No gripe to him. Casas has cooled off immensely since his initial return. Story actually had a decent series in New York overall. But then Abreu takes a step forward this season. At this point in time, you have to be mad at the bullpen construction, how guys are performing this late in the season offensively, and just the overall flatness. I have not seen them have energy in weeks. That's Garrett's start. I wouldn't even call that energy. Garrett Cole just threw up all over himself. Yeah. There's been no – it's been awful. It's been awful. So, and like, that's my main thing. Now, I will say something positive about the season as a whole. If you zoom out, to think of where we thought we would be at this time, what you wanted to happen did happen. Willier took a step forward. He looks like a true major league corner outfielder. He's going to be a piece moving forward, either if he's traded or if he's on the team next year. Good. Farm system progressed. Good. Tanner Houck, by a country mile, adjusted the best to Andrew Bailey's new system. Awesome. But that's not enough. You're the Boston Red Sox. You can't be proud, happy, pat yourself on the back for a decent season where two or three guys are really good. And that's my biggest gripe on the season as a whole.
So, Pat, the response I have to that, and maybe it's just my view of the overall pitching infrastructure, which I'll say over and over again, I think this is a It has to be a long-term overhaul of the infrastructure. You bring new guys into the system, and these guys work under the new infrastructure, and those are the guys that get to come up with it. But we'll look at it from this season just alone. You talked about, you know, guys burning out, and you know, you approach the deadline with those guys knowing that there's a chance that they could burn out. You know, guys like Cutter Crawford, Tanner Houck, Zach Kelly, specifically in this series, guys who are over their max innings that they've achieved in their professional careers. The issue is there's no, like, I want to look at it from an offseason perspective, because my issue is from a deadline perspective, where you were at the deadline, unless you were going to go out there and get three different starting pitchers. If guys like Tanner Houck and Cutter Crawford and Zach Kelly, if these guys were all going to take steps back in the second half, there weren't deadline additions that were going to be able to stop that. However, if in the offseason, like, you sign, you know, Michael Lorenzen and a couple other starting pitchers, granted, yes, like Tanner Houck starts the season in the bullpen, but we've seen that these guys get hurt, and eventually Houck makes his way into the rotation, has a couple of good seven-inning, two-run outings. Like, you know, he fortifies himself in the rotation, and all of a sudden you've got 10 starting pitchers worth of depth on your team. But if you're going to wait to the trade deadline to do it, you're just asking to decimate your farm. So my issues all lie in the fact that this ownership group hasn't spent enough money. If you're asking Craig Breslow to continue diving into the farm system every year at the trade deadline to make additions there because ownership won't supplement the team with money, then you're just not asking for sustainability. It all has to happen. Like, you need to have an ownership group that is willing to put in the money needed, because it's not just about putting talent on the field. It's about not needing to completely decimate your farm system year after year after year to supplement your team at the deadline. You got to come into the year prepared, and they were not prepared this year. This was a year where everything needed to go right for this team to be good. Obviously, not everything went right, and it left this team with a bunch of spots where they needed to fill at the deadline to be competitive. They certainly did their best to do it within reason, but the amount of holes that they had to fill meant that they had to take cheaper routes to fill those holes and take bigger gambles, and those gambles did not work. But my fingers pointed at ownership, because if they had the ammo ready to back this team up entering the season, then maybe all they would have needed at the deadline was a relief pitcher and they could have aimed higher, or a right-handed bat and they could have shot for the stars. But they had to fill five goddamn holes in one deadline. If you're going to do that and your playoff odds are 30%, I'm sorry, it's not smart baseball to shoot for the high end of the trade deadline market with five different freaking trades.
I feel like that's a little bit of rewriting history. They were a game out and they just needed Gordo's room service pie just showed up. Sorry. No, I mean, like, they didn't need anything crazy. They needed better than James Paxton. I remember my head felt like it was going to explode when the deadline passed and that was the only move they made. And it, like, not to toot my own horn, but like, happened instantly. It's just frustrating, man. And I agree with Gordo. You should be pointing at ownership for the majority of the failures. However, that doesn't mean the players are absolved. The way they've been playing the last maybe month or so, we'll just keep it to this Yankee series, but the way that these guys have been playing for that series, that's not acceptable. Like, no matter who you are, you're fighting for a playoff spot. The Twins on a nightly basis are just pooping their pants and puking all over themselves. They can barely put two wins together for the life of them. They're begging you to take over, and the Tigers pass you. It's just like, yeah, at the end of the day, when we look back on the season, we can blame ownership. But right now, you cannot be okay with the way these guys are playing, because we know they're better than this and they've played better than this. And it just feels like when the pressure hits, these guys have fallen apart, which is disappointing. And I don't think it's a Cora thing. I do think it's a lot of like an experience thing and the way they were kind of set up to fail almost in a way by ownership. It always comes back to ownership, no matter how you slice it. But that doesn't mean we absolve the players for some really gross play this last week or so.
Yeah. And real quick, I just want to go back to the spending thing. When I say spending, and Gordo, I assume you're in the same boat from the offseason. I'm not saying you should have gone out and you should have signed Ohtani. You should have signed Yoshinobu Yamamoto. What I am saying is, in no fucking world should the Boston Red Sox be outbid for Seth Lugo, who would be a massive upgrade, for Teoscar Hernandez, who would be arguably the biggest hole on the team in a right-handed bat. And like, though, that's the terms of spending I'm talking about. Being too cheap to go up to $5 to $10 million on guys like that. Yeah, sure, ideally you get your Yamamoto or your Ohtani, whatever. But being outbid on those guys who truly fit the holes that you have and being outbid by teams that are one quarter of the market size as you is pathetic. It's so pathetic.
So, Pat, I want to look at, and I want to go back to a point that Sammy made, because Sammy's saying that there's no excuse for how they're playing right now. I agree with that, but I look at it from two different sides of the ball, because I think there's the pitching staff that's been asked from April until now to do things that they shouldn't be asked to do, certainly not all at once. And then there's the bats. The pitching staff, what do you guys, if you had to guess this year, what do you think the Red Sox starter ERA is?
Starter?
Yeah.
4.36.
Okay, we're in the same.
3.381.
Okay, yeah, a little lower. I feel like that's carried by Hauk a lot.
It is. But what I'm saying is, if you told me going into the year that would be the Red Sox starter ERA, I'd be thrilled. And to be honest with you, for the last month or so, the starters have been good. The bullpen has been bad. But the bullpen also is filled with guys that are being asked to do things they haven't done. The offense, Sammy, and this goes to your point of being frustrated with the way they're playing, and there's no excuse to play like the way they've been for honestly a month now.
Yeah.
It all lies in the offense, because these are guys that have done it before. And I get that Rafi Devers specifically here, he's playing through an injury, he hasn't hit a homer since August 25th. I get it. Duran is going through a slump. It's hard to get mad at him because it's kind of the first extended slump that he's gone through the entire year. But the fact of the matter is, these are must-win games, and they're not stepping up to the plate when it matters the most. And we saw this offense be so good for so much of this year. And it's hard for me, I think, to say this, because I had such low expectations for the offense coming into the season. I actually said that I thought the offense would be this team's biggest weakness this year. But the truth of the matter is, they proved me wrong in the middle parts of the season. And that's why you should not accept the production from the offense that we've seen in the months of August and September. And why I get that there are, you know, whether you talk about the lack of right-handed hitting, the all of the strikeouts and the swing and miss from this team, there are things that need to change in the offseason to make this offense more consistent.
But to move to like the roster construct, like Chaim Bloom, I like what he did with the farm, but like, have you ever seen a baseball team before? You can't have all left-handed guys. It's so simple how to shut these guys down. Like Carlos Rodon, who's been nothing special all year. I think he had a 4.21 ERA coming into the game today. Just shut the Red Sox down. Only Tyler O'Neill, the righty, who Chaim Bloom didn't acquire, did any damage. So it's just like, how is that guy the GM at any point? How are they still not spending money? How did they not make more changes heading into the season with the roster, not with the coaching staff, the personnel? It's so not Red Sox. I hate talking about these guys like they're the friggin' A's. We shouldn't be celebrating a mediocre season, especially with the context of what it was like coming into the season and the years before. It's just so frustrating. Like, how many years are we going to have to do this before something gives? And I want to say next year, it looks like next year they're going to be really good. You have an unbelievable farm system, but these are prospects. We don't know if they're all going to hit. And if they don't all hit, are the Red Sox going to supplement? I don't know.
The other issue is, even if they do all hit, if the Red Sox don't make changes, all it's going to be is a bunch of awesome left-handed bats. That doesn't solve the issue of the Red Sox not being able to hit righties. Like, you're going to ask a bunch of young lefties to hit lefties too? No, they're going to have to make changes to add right-handed bats. They're going to have to make changes to limit the strikeouts. Like, coming into this year, a serious gripe that you – and I think that Craig Breslow has done a better job than most people think that he's done. But one thing that he did was he let Justin Turner go, and he traded Alex Verdugo, and he didn't bring anyone in to limit the strikeouts. So what do you expect to happen? Like, this team is one of the most strikeout-heavy teams in the league because they have one player in Masataka Yoshida that doesn't strike out at least a decent amount. Like everyone else is like in the bottom 25% of the league in striking out. So yeah, that was going to be an issue. Like some of the other things you can point at and say, yeah, it was the lack of spending, but that to me, like it almost feels like an oversight. I don't know if I want to go there, but it almost feels like that to me.
What do you mean? Feels like an oversight.
Like it feels like an oversight that they came in to spring training with like a group of hitters that like as a whole, if you look at them one by one by one, like, yeah, it's a good group of hitters. But when you assemble a group of hitters where on any given day, 8 out of the 9 guys are going to be strikeout heavy guys, you're going to have an inconsistent group that can strike out double digit times on any given night. And that's what this team's been.
Yeah. And I mean, like, look at the 2007 Red Sox. Ellsbury, really good speed, top of the order, gets on base a ton, can run a little bit of pop. Euclid batting second, on base machine, plays good defense. Like, everyone did multiple things. And then, of course, you get into like Ortiz and Ramirez. Ramirez and Ortiz, however, the lineup was that day. It's just like this team, like, you have Yoshida, who you just mentioned. He makes contact. That's pretty much it. Puts the ball in play, not much power, no speed at all. They don't even trust him to play defense. You got Tyler O'Neill, who's had a good season. He hits home runs, mostly off of left-handed pitching. What else? That's it. It's just so... You don't have many guys who are... And I don't expect you to have many guys like Rafael Devers, but guys like Devers in that they, you know, on-base machine, they also have power. You know, like, do multiple things. It's too many one-dimensional players, and, like, guys like that have... They have roles in Major League Baseball, but you can't have a team full of those guys. And that's what this Red Sox team felt like and feels like now. So it's so frustrating because this could have been avoided. And we all knew it. We all said it coming into the season. We all said pretty much the same thing. Maybe these guys surprise us, but even if they do surprise us, our hope is for meaningful baseball in September. And, you know, they've gotten there, and I said I wouldn't be mad if they got there. But then you take the context of the way that they've been playing in September. And
it's okay for you to be mad. Yeah. It's okay. It's okay if you're listening to this and you're mad at the shit that you've seen in September because you want the team to go down fighting and they haven't done that. And it's frustrating because if like the team played even like okay baseball for the last month, they'd be in a playoff spot. And it hasn't gone that way. You look at other things, and I wanna target game 2 specifically, the second game of the series. The Red Sox were up 4-0. And I'll run through the situation here, how it went down. It was Cora went to Justin Slayton in the sixth. Aaron Judge was up in the sixth. He wanted Justin Slayton for the meat of their order. Justin Slayton gets through the sixth. Now you've got to get through the seventh, eighth, and ninth. Let's assume that he's got Martin and Jansen ready for the eighth and the ninth. Seventh inning comes around. You've got to get through that inning. It's the bottom of the Yankees lineup. Who are you going to throw in that spot? There were a lot of people very upset that Alex Cora went to Zach Kelly in that spot. The way it played out, Zach Kelly, I believe the order was walk, walk, single, and then pulled for Boozer who walked. It was walk, walk, single, walk. I don't know where Kelly was pulled for Boozer, but basically Kelly loads the bases up, lets in a run, and then Boozer lets up a game-tying grand slam. So Yankees take a 5-4 lead. So the seventh inning obviously didn't go according to plan. Basically, if the Red Sox even could have come out of that seventh inning with like a 2-run lead or 1-run lead, like you have to feel okay at least about Martin and Jansen finishing the job. But obviously they didn't get through the seventh inning. Were you guys okay with the bullpen management in that spot? Because personally to me, if you ask me over the course of the season for the guys available, after Jansen, Martin, and Slayton, who has been your next most trusted guy? I'm not saying he's been great because he's certainly faltered in a lot of crucial spots, but I think Zach Kelly would come forth. So I don't really have a problem with him entering in that spot. A lot of people wanted Luis Guerrero. At that point, had thrown 2 innings in his big league career. Has looked the part, looked really good. But to me, Zach Kelly Luis Guerrero in that spot.
That tells you everything you need to know right there. Is that a lot of people wanted Luis Guerrero in that massive spot. Luis Guerrero, who's pitched like 5 major league innings in his life. That's how bad the roster construction is. And who the fuck else are you going to go to?
Zach Kelly,
Guerrero?
Sammy, we agree. The roster construction is like the roster is not built to eat the 6th, 7th, 8th, and 9th innings of a close game. Even in a 4-run game, it's not built to eat it. But in that spot for Alex Cora, Sal Sequoia doesn't control the roster construction.
Nope.
Do you?
No, I'm agreeing with you. I'm saying that's how bad the options are. Zach's been good, but he doesn't have a ton of major league experience, and he always gets put in the hardest spots. That's been his role this year. That's a lot for him to do. Luis Guerrero, the other option you mentioned, like I said, he's barely pitched at the major league level. And then Boozer, who wasn't even in baseball 2 years ago. Like, these are the guys. Like, look, I love a good baseball story. I like Cam Boozer's story. I like Jamie Westbrook's story. I like Zach Penrod's story. I like Mickey Gasper's story. But you're the Boston Red Sox. You shouldn't have a team full of these Disney Channel kind of stories that got them to Major League Baseball. That's what the Oakland A's do. And that's why when people complain about, oh, Alex Cora, why would you be putting XYZ in this spot? Because he has no one else to go to. You can't put Chris Martin, who's almost 40, in the game every single friggin' night. He's already missed time, by the way. Kenley Jansen can't go multiple innings every single friggin' game. What's he supposed to do? I see this all the time, Gordo. I agree with you. People complain, Cora's a good manager, but I don't know about his bullpen usage. You try to do it. Who are you going to go to in that spot? It's
that's doing great. That's the thing is, with bullpens, you're going to have guys like these guys. Sammy, you just talked about all these guys with these stories. Like that's what being a reliever in so many cases in Major League Baseball is these guys come from all of these spots. They found some stuff and the teams try them out. And a lot of these, not a lot, some of these guys turn into legitimate arms, but you got to build your way up to that. The guys that are stories like the Cam Boozers, Zach Penrod, was in independent baseball a year ago. Cam Boozer, obviously, his story is very well documented. He got hit by a car and he was a carpenter. These guys generally. These guys generally, for like at least a year and a half, they have to prove themselves pitching low leverage. Because it's hard to work your way and prove yourself. Whereas, and that's, you look at teams like the Dodgers, that's how those guys get their way up is they, and it works like that with the rotation too. That's how they work their way into the rotation. Even if they were starters in the minors, they have to work their way up through the bullpen and by pitching in the minors longer than they ideally should. But with the Red Sox, it's like guys come up and they pitch like two or three good innings. And then all of a sudden it's like, all right, if he's pitched two or three good innings since getting called up, he's probably at this point better than what we have in the bullpen. So let's put him in the high leverage spots or let's at least talk about it. Mm-hmm. It just goes to show you that there's not enough talent. But Pat, I want to get your take. Were you upset at the bullpen usage or are you pointing to the roster construction like Sammy and I are?
You have to look at the roster construction. So let's say we'll play devil's advocate. We'll go with the people on Twitter who are pissed about it. So if you save Slayton for the inning that Kelly and Boozer ended up pitching, right? And you just flip-flop them like people wanted to do. The same shit likely happens just an inning earlier. It's the same part of the order. So sure, like if you flip-flop them, a bad outing is a bad outing, no matter where you put it. You can't get mad at Cora. The other thing is, this isn't the NFL. Roster sizes are not 53. They're 26. If you are on the major league roster, you have to play. You have to be able to play. And to think that Cora is just going to throw out the same four guys out of the bullpen every single game is so naive and stupid. He has guys, and guys cannot play every day. So then he turns to guys 24, 25, and 26 on the major league roster to fill these innings because he has to, because the roster construction's a mess, and then it implodes and people point the finger at Cora for putting him in. But what's he supposed to do? That's his roster.
So Pat, I'll ask you guys. He put in Zach Kelly for the 7th. Clearly the idea here was let's get a couple of outs, and if it gets to the lefty portion of the order, which I believe it started with Soto. So basically the lefty pocket here is Soto, and then you got Judge a righty, but then you got Austin Wells a lefty. So the goal here was going to be maybe get a couple of outs, and then you can go to the lefty for that pocket. Were you guys okay? Would you have rather seen Guerrero over Zach Kelly? And this is obviously we have the benefit of hindsight, but understanding that in that moment, Guerrero had two innings of major league experience. Zach Kelly overall has had a positive season, but in a lot of big spots has crumbled, and certainly crumbled in that White Sox game. And now we have the benefit of hindsight, but going back, taking you back to that moment, Kelly or Guerrero in that spot, who are you taking? Because I'm taking Kelly.
Kelly, easy. Because I don't know if you put Guerrero in. At that point, he had thrown, what, two major league innings? Yeah. Putting in a kid like that, his third career inning against that part of the Yankees order in Yankee Stadium, and you think he's going to do better, if not the same as Zach Kelly, that's insane to me. I would go Kelly 10 times out of 10.
Sammy, what would you put?
I probably would have gone Guerrero, but not because I think he's a better fit for that spot, just because I feel like this point in the season is like you got to catch lightning in a bottle somehow. So I would have gone that way. But that's like a 51% confidence rate. Like Zach Kelly, it's not a bad conceptual. How do I put it? The idea wasn't bad, just the result was. So I don't think it's hard for me to criticize Cora very much for that, because it's like those are your two options. Zach's been more good than bad this year. I agree. Guerrero, very inexperienced. The stuff is nasty. He's got like one knee, which is cool, but still, either way, you're not. You don't have those veterans. Like every good team, like I mentioned the 2007 team, in that spot they could have gone to like Okajima. 2013 team, they had guys you could go to. 2018 team didn't even have the greatest bullpen of all time, but they still had veterans that they could go to in those spots. And it's just like, yeah, man, every conversation we've had today, it all leads to the same spot. Why did they not have veterans, or why did they not have better personnel? And with the bullpen, you know, not a mulligan, but you did acquire two guys who were on fire when you got them, and they had, you know, decent track records of major league success. So that I kind of,
you feel about a little bit.
But with the lineup, and like the rotation overall, and the rotation's not been bad, but it's still not like a contender looking rotation. Roster construction, man. No, yes, exactly. There's no stopper. Tanner Houck has had a great season, but you can't expect a guy to just become a guy, a stopper, like you just said, in year one as a starter. And by the way, I don't even want to give the Red Sox full credit for Tanner Houck, because he wasn't even supposed to be in the rotation to start. He's only in there because Giolito got hurt. So half credit to the Red Sox for that one.
Yeah, I mean, I feel like there's two different conversations to be had, because obviously with the bullpen, they acquired two relief pitchers in Sims and Garcia that both, as you said, Sammy, had good track records and were pitching very well heading into the trade deadline. Obviously, neither of those guys had a lot of success with the Red Sox. Both guys got hurt. I know Lucas Sims is in Worcester now, so looks like he might make a comeback, but a little bit too little too late.
Just in time, baby.
Just in time for the big twin series, man.
That's maybe gonna be so, you know, on big. The bright side. And I don't want to be too positive, because I'm not in a positive mood. On the bright side, for 2025, in theory, you're going to have Michael Fulmer and Liam Hendricks in the back of the bullpen. Those are two veterans, both of whom have closing experience, especially Hendricks. So maybe some of that gets alleviated. But
the issue.
There's also the chance that you lose both Kenley and Martin. So
yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah.
Who knows? I'm not.
That's why I've said literally step one, and I hope it happens. Like literally, and they can negotiate with him, I believe, before free agency starts. But step one of the offseason is re-signing Chris Martin. And we're going to get to those discussions down the road. And like as soon as the offseason hits, like I promise you, we're going to have more of these discussions. But as we hit, we are running up on time. But I need to get all of our takes here. We haven't even talked about the Gerrit Cole shit. The wimpiest intentional walk of all time. And I want to talk about that before we talk about the hit by pitch. So save the hit by pitch takes. But Gerrit Cole with the wimpiest intentional walk of all time, just to paint the situation, fourth inning, he's throwing a no-hitter, gets Jaron Duran out, so he's got one out in the fourth inning, intentionally walks Devers, which instantly Devers steals second, then he walks another, you know, leads to three runs, and then he lets up four the next inning. So he goes from throwing a no-hitter to allowing seven runs. And it all starts with intentionally walking Devers, which the Yankees players, and by players, I mean Cole and Austin Wells, the catcher, and Aaron Boone gave incredibly vague and mixed messaging about after the game, saying it was part of the game plan, but Austin Wells didn't even know it was part of the game plan. Like, just, it was a whole mess of shit to me that I get it, like, wanting, I know their bullpen was decimated and they wanted to figure out how to get Cole deeper into the game, and like, they weren't going to throw Devers strikes anyway, so why not just put him on? But again, we've talked about managing the game with your head and not, and like, understanding that you don't put the game tying run on. The worst thing Devers can do is hit a home run and tie the game. You don't purposely put the game tying run on. I don't care where in the game you are. I don't care who's hitting behind the guy. It's just not something you do. Devers can't beat you in that moment. So why let him get in your head? Clearly Cole was flustered from that point on. I thought it was insane.
I mean, that was maybe the most Garrett Cole moment of all time. There's no, if you ask me, like, if you describe that scenario and said, which pitcher would do this? I don't think I would even hesitate. That's like the most Garrett Cole thing of all time. And even so, I was pretty shocked when that happened. I saw a statistic. I just tried to find it, but I think there's only been like, there's been like under 10 intentional walks with the bases empty in a situation like that. It's insane to do. Like, it's that was one of the weakest shows of weakness I've ever seen. Like, what more can you say? That's fucking sad, man. Come on, Garrett. You're making $300 million and you're scared to pitch to a guy with the, in your own house with the bases empty. It's just like, you could just go on and on and on. And that picture of him on the mound with the four fingers up. I wish the Red Sox had at least split this series so we could look back on that more fondly. But I'm just forever going to remember just being furious at the end of the series. But still, that was fun. I liked seeing that.
The thing is, it's like you got a Hall of Fame pitcher on the mound. It's not like it's just some slapdick. Like, it's a Hall of Fame pitcher who hasn't intentionally walked anyone since 2017. So, like, you have to have, like, at least a little bit of pride, a little bit of balls. Like, fuck the game plan, man. Like, you're a competitor. That was crazy to me.
Pat, yeah, for a Yankees fan, like, that's your guy, too. That's, like, your ace. And he's great. He's a great pitcher. But, like, mentally, this guy, friggin' full-time access to Weenie Hut Jr. is, my God, sad.
Pat, what do you think when you see this? Joe's got the picture of Garrett Cole with the four fingers up. Pat, what goes through your head when you see those four fingers?
The best part was Raffy's reaction. It was the video of him after, and he like looks at the ump, he goes, "Is he walking me?" And just kind of like awkwardly like drops the bat, and like undoes his pads because he didn't believe it. Yeah, no, see, I mean, you hit the nail on the head. You got to be a mental, I won't say that word. You got to be pretty weak to four pitch or for to intentional walk a guy, one out, bases empty, after throwing at him, which I think was some bush league bullshit.
Can we get to move on to the hit by pitch?
Yeah. I side with Cora, absolutely. Last week on I think it was Latino Heritage Week or Heritage Day, they asked him what Latin hitter gave you the most trouble. He says Raffy. Everyone laughs, and the first pitch to Raffy, the first at bat after he says that, he plunks him. Then he immediately intentionally walks him. And then later in the game, I mean, daddy's going to do what daddy's going to do. And he hits an RBI single and knocks Cole out of the game. But, yeah, Bush League, he's – Garrett Cole's a giant pussy.
Can we pull up the replay?
Pat, you thought the hit-by-pitch was on purpose?
Oh, my God, yes.
Joe, can we pull up the replay? I want to point something out, because this actually, I said earlier the intentional walk was the most Garrett Cole thing of all time. If you look at the replay, okay, hold on. When you hit a guy with a pitch intentionally, it's generally with a four seam fastball, right? That's your fastest pitch. It's straight. It's easy to aim. I'm pretty sure Garrett Cole intentionally hit Rafael Devers with a cut fastball, which to me seems like him trying to leave room. And here it is, if you're watching on YouTube. Oh, no, that's the double. I like that too. Either way, Garrett Cole, when he went to intentionally hit Rafael Devers, he hits him with a cutter, which to me is Garrett Cole leaving room for plausible deniability in case there's a retaliation, which is god tier soft shit right there. Like you're gonna hit the guy, you're like, well, it was a cutter, so I who knows if it was on purpose. A 92 mile an hour cutter, I wasn't throwing my hardest.
The other thing too is, because Raffy's a lefty, it's even running more into him. It's not like he's throwing it to a righty and he's like kind of like grazing him as it's coming in.
And look at this. Okay, so here it is. Yeah.
Yeah, that's a cutter that starts at his elbow and goes into his ribs.
91. So if that was intentional and he chose to go with the cutter instead of the four-seam fastball, I'll say it again. I really think that was Gerrit Cole leaving room for plausible deniability in case there was a retaliation, which is the weakest shit I have ever seen. And it's so Gerrit Cole. Amazing. I love it.
Can I give you guys all of the evidence you need as to why it was intentional?
Please.
They talk about the game plan, and Cole was saying before the fourth inning, they talked about the game plan, about how if they got Duran out and there was one out and no one on, they were going to intentionally walk Devers. That was the game plan. One out, no one on, Devers gets walked. So tell me, in the first inning, the situation was one out, no one on. So the game plan in that spot, they've told you, is to put Devers on first base. They just chose a different method to do it. They just chose to hit him in this case.
It's very badass. You know what else is makes it even softer? Is it's no secret. Devers is not healthy right now. His shoulder is tapped. He can't. His throws look off. His swing looks like a completely different swing plane than it normally does. He just doesn't look like himself. And still, he gets Gerrit Cole and gets inside his head. Just crazy. I can't recall. I was trying to think yesterday. Can you guys think of any hitter owning a pitcher this badly? I got one.
A good pitcher.
Yeah. Not some schmuck, but like a good. I got one, but I don't think it's the same level. You guys got any?
Oh.
No, who do you have?
Let me just double check. I'm thinking Enrique Wilson from like the early 2000s Yankees just destroyed Pedro. He was like a utility infielder, but they would bat him. Yeah, 11 for 25 against Pedro. He just hit Pedro really well. Yeah, hit 440 off of Pedro, and he would always hit low in their order. And like normally he'd be on the bench, but when Pedro was pitching, the Yankees would put Enrique Wilson in.
Tony Gwynn also owned Greg Maddux.
Oh, yeah. Didn't
Tony Gwynn hit 409 in 103 at-bats against Greg Maddux. Wow. That's absurd. That is bad insane.
Yeah. The way Tony Gwynn played, that's like that kind of plays into the way Maddux pitches. So
yeah,
that's interesting. We just should.
We're gonna be talking about Devers, Cole. Pat, you got one more? What do you got? Pat's got a look.
Tony Gwynn never struck out against Greg Maddux.
How many at-bats?
103.
That's crazy.
That is insane.
Okay, hold on. Let's look up Rafael Devers. Let's get the final count.
The crazy thing is Cole has struck him out a fair amount. If you've got the stats up, like Cole strikes him out too.
Got him. Ready? I'll go down the line. He's 14 for 40, which is a .350 batting average, 8 home runs, 20 RBIs, 46 plate appearances, 15 strikeouts. So you're right, Gordo. He does strike out a lot, but also 9 extra base hits.
That's the thing. It's
20 RBIs, and he's slugging .975 off of Cole. Slugging, not OPS. Slugging.
And then I don't have the numbers in front of me. I just remember it from like a John Boy clip of them interviewing Boone. But I think he's faced Cole 5 times when it was the third time through the order. So it's like the third time he's seen him that day. And I think in those 5 at-bats, he's homered 4 times. So it's like, and we talked to Chris Murphy about this too. Like we interviewed Chris Murphy and Murph talked to Devers about why he owns Cole. And Raffy's just like, yeah, like I just know that Cole's going to throw me what I haven't been hitting well lately. So I know what's going to come and I hit it. So
mind games.
Like, he's just got his number. Raffy's a dad.
In that same interview, when they were talking about the third time through, I am pretty sure, I'll have to look this up after and I'll confirm or deny, I'm pretty sure the third time in the game that Raffy sees Gerrit Cole, his OPS is 3.04 something. It's like 3.047. That is insanity. That is brutal.
Yeah. So in conclusion, Gerrit Cole has a daddy, and his name's Rafi. It is the truth. The Red Sox, of course, even in the state that they're in right now, could not lose to Gerrit Cole. It does not matter which iteration of the Red Sox is facing Gerrit Cole, especially if they have Rafi Devers on the team and he's healthy. They're going to get to him in some way. Rafi's going to get him. So before we get out of here, though, because we got to wrap this thing up, but there was one piece of news that came out during the Sunday broadcast, and it's that Joe Castiglione is going to retire after, I believe it's 42 seasons calling Red Sox games on the radio, which is unfathomable. I know that Sammy has been around for like all 42 of those. Like, he remembers those fondly, but Pat and I here, like, we're in our 20s. So like, Joe Castig has been on the radio and calling these games. It's been our entire lives. And it's just, it's the soundtrack of your summer. If you're listening on the radio, like, you, I remember my dad would drive me back from baseball games as a kid. And obviously you turn on the radio and there's Castig. And it's just like, that's what you expected. And he was always there, and it's going to be, obviously he's been part-time for some time now. So it's not like it's going to be like a shock when he's not calling the games. Like, we're very used to Will Fleming and Lou Maloney, but he's just such a legend, and obviously gets his Hall of Fame induction this year, which was awesome to see. And like, I'm glad that he's getting his flowers while he's still in the booth, which is something great that can happen for a broadcaster that can't necessarily happen for a player. Like, he gets to go get inducted into the Hall of Fame and, you know, call a game the next week. And it was great to see that. And he got to talk about it, and you got to hear from him. But obviously wish him nothing but the best in retirement, and hope he is not a stranger at Fenway Park. I hope we see him so often at Fenway Park. I don't know where he lives, but I really do hope we see him a lot. And he's just had such an unbelievable run as the Red Sox radio broadcaster.
He did say he's still going to be around, so it's not like he's gone, which is nice. I want to say that for the three of us, this is our first year being credentialed media with the Red Sox, and when we are in the media dining room and Joe Castiglione is sitting like a table away and you can hear him talking, for us, like, it's a weird sensation, because like, that voice is so synonymous with listening to the Red Sox on the radio and that Marsha commercial. It's just to meet him and like just to share the same space as him, it's an honor. And it's so cool, and we're very fortunate. And it's gonna be weird without Joe. Yeah.
I'm still get starstruck every time I get to produce a game and I get to be in his ear, like saying, "Hey, we need to get this live drop in." And feeding stats to him, like, it's still like, I still get nervous. Like, I literally get anxiety if I gotta like talk to him or anything like that, because he's that incredible and that legendary.
Yeah. And I think for me, like, I'll always remember being 9, 10, 11, 12 years old, like late night driving home from like an all-star baseball game. It's like 8:30, 9 o'clock at night. And just driving back home from games with my dad and having Joe Castig's voice calling Sox games. It gets so synonymous with like me growing up, listening to the Sox games after my own baseball games. And to this day, I listen to Joe on the radio. And it's going to be so strange when he's not a full-time announcer anymore, because he's just been kind of like the staple for us. He's like, it's like Fenway Park, Don Orsillo, Joe Castiglione. Like, those have been like just mainstays for our childhood, and then Castig obviously through our adult life, but it's going to be weird.
Yeah. I mean, yeah. Nothing but love for Joe Castig, and just wishing him all the best in his retirement. And one of those guys where it's like, I wonder what he's going to do in his retirement with all the extra time on his hands, but I'm sure he'll make the most of it. And yeah, will not be a stranger. We're just very thankful for the time that we had getting to listen to him throughout all these years. But to wrap up right there, Sox drop 3 of 4 to the Yankees. As you can tell, we get more and more big picture with every one of these podcasts that passes. But we've got a couple weeks left in this season to watch these games and learn more about these guys, and certainly learn more about the September call-up kind of guys. And Triple A season ends soon, so maybe we see Vaughn Grissom get called up at some point. He's been playing really well in Triple A, but I'm sure there will be more to come from guys that you haven't seen a lot of this year. I'm sure at minimum you'll see more of Luis Guerrero and Zach Penrod, who have looked good out of that bullpen and are sort of auditioning for 2025 roles. But we will be in your ear tomorrow talking Sox Rays series preview, everything that there is to hear about that series. But till then, we appreciate you guys tuning in. Before we get going, before you tune into something else, go about your day, whatever, remember, hit that subscribe button. Wherever you're listening, wherever you get your podcasts, hit the subscribe button, rate us 5 stars, all platforms. You can check us out on YouTube at the WEI channel. We got a Play Tessie playlist in there where all the episodes are. Hit the 5 stars on those videos. We really appreciate it. At Play Tessie on all of the socials, at Twitter, or on Twitter and on Instagram, at Play Tessie. Find us all there. For Sammy and for Pat, for Joe producing, it's Gordo here. Viva Joe Castig for Play Tessie episode 130. Thanks for tuning in. Peace.